Hi, Guillermo. Thank you for dropping by today.
It's great to be here, Randy. Thanks a lot for having me on your show.
What musicians have influenced your not only your style of playing, but your musical concept?
There are many musicians that have influenced me. For playing, I could name you different percussionists, a drummer such as Robertinho Silva is a great drummer from Brazil. He's been involved with many major artists. You may have heard of Milton Nascimento. Then more in the jazz, so the Brazilian jazz style, Edson Machado is another great drummer from Brazil that influenced me very much. Of course, I listen to a lot of Latin jazz, and I love Ignacio Barroa. And in terms of composition, you know, Milton Nascimento is a great composer that I've listened to it since I was a young kid. There are many composers in Argentina that I love, such as Astor Piazzolla. Alberto Ginastera is another composer I love. Villalobos, a Brazilian composer. And then more modern composers, when I came to the United States, I started to hear them, listen to them, rather, such as, you know, Egberto Gismonti and Hermeto Pascual, more in the 80s. And since I've been in the United States for so long, you know, more than 20 years, I have heard, you know, many composers here, primarily Wayne Shorter. I found him a great source of inspiration in terms of his, you know, writing, his soul develop and all that.
What drummers have influenced your style of playing?
Well, in terms of, you know, drummers such as Robertinho Silva, he's just so creative. I mean, he's used the concepts, you know, as to how he uses, you know, every instrument. And, you know, let me clarify what I feel about the drums first. You know, the drums is not one instrument, but a series of instruments. You know, the snare drum is one instrument, and then, you know, the tom is another instrument, and cymbals another instrument, and hi-hat is another instrument. Let's do not forget that, you know, in 1920s or 30th, you know, all those instruments were played by different people. Now, he's got an approach to the drum set that is really unique. I've seen him live many times. You know, his son is also a percussionist, and they do incredible wonders, you know. It's just like, and also his brain is pretty much connected to Milton. I mean, Milton Nascimento and him, they like work in the same wavelength. It's really terrific what they do. Edson Machado, I love his playing. It's kind of like the Brazilian Elvin Jones, Edson Machado. He is the first person who started to sort of mess around with the Brazilian jazz, you know, type of style. And he's terrific. Of course, I got a lot of influence from American drummers, North American drummers, rather, I should say. You know, such as Tony Williams, you know, incredible, you know, right hand and cymbal development, you know, especially in this live Carnegie Hall double record recorded with Miles Davis. He's absolutely outstanding, and you know, on that recording.
Do you ever listen to older recordings to maybe get a new idea or a musical twist that you might incorporate into your own playing and composing?
I do listen to all the recordings, especially in periods when I am studying, you know, new things to play. Yes, of course, I do go back and listen to, you know, an Oscar Peterson recording, and trying to get, you know, to listen to Tony Williams, so, you know, with Miles, so, you know, trying to listen to Elvin with John Coltrane, especially if I'm focusing in, you know, and doing things that I didn't grow up with. And sometimes I just listen to old recordings because, you know, they're great, and I'm in the mood to listen to that. Primarily, the old recordings, so to speak, you know, it would be kind of silly not to listen to them, since they're there in and it's like if you want to play classical piano and you got to listen to some of the guys who did recordings of Beethoven or Mozart or whatever, if the recordings are available, of course, and then take it to the next level, and just listen for inspiration and things like that. So the examples that I could tell you that I've done recently is primarily focusing on Elvin John's recordings, such as John Coltrane's Crescent. John Coltrane is his music is when I was younger was incomprehensible to me. I didn't know what was going on there. And now, jazz is a very, very difficult language. Now that I study for all these years and I did a lot of research on it, when I listen to John Coltrane, we call it old, but it sounds like he recorded yesterday. It's really very, very advanced.
Do you look for situations that might be musically challenging for you? I know there are some musicians who would prefer to play it safe and just remain in that kind of style, but there are other musicians who like the challenge and the everything that goes with it, I was just wondering if you're that type of musician.
Yeah, it definitely is a lifelong quest. I look for situations that are challenging. It's not always easy to find them, either because the opportunity doesn't come when you want to find them, or people tend to be busy and stuff, and things like that. But si those situations are vital for me. I used to not do that, and now I realize that I need the challenge, in many levels, and the musical level, but also in the human level too. Meaning with that is it's great to be with different people and to change. In fact, sometimes I do that on purpose. I change personnel because I just want to be with different kinds of people, either different background, different nationalities, and I found that vital. The human experience, the contact that I have with musicians, it affects the music you do. You don't just go out there and do necessarily what you want to do when you're on the stage. You are completely being influenced by, your peers.
Are there any musicians who are no longer with us that you would have liked to have performed with?
I don't tend to think that way, I certainly miss a lot of people. And thank God for the, the new technology with CDs and things like that, that these people got to record, and you can still have them with you. I guess if I could name a few people, I mean, recently when Joe Henderson died, and Joe Henderson has played with my keyboard player, Elio Alves, so I got to, kind of know him a little closer. I mean, he was an incredible saxophone player. It would have been great to do something with him, but I don't usually think about people who are not here anymore in a sense that I would have liked to either meet them or not meet them. I just think about them as to what they conveyed or what they have given me and the rest, of the artists and audience, who have the privilege to hear them either live or on recordings.
What does El Eco mean?
Yeah, everyone asks me that question, often in interviews. El Eco, ELECO, no, in Spanish. What does it mean? It simply in English means the echo, ECHO. Now I'm sure you're thinking, why did I put that name, to the band? I think there was a tune in the folkloric Latin American folkloric repertoire that was called El Eco. Some CD that I came across, in the 80s, in the 80s when I formed the band. The band has been around for many years, And I just like the sound of it. So I wanted to name the band El Eco, ELECO, which is the you know, the echo. So that's the answer to that one.
If you had to make a recording with only one musician, who would that be?
I haven't thought about this. Who would I record with in the last year? I've been actually working with musicians who are so wonderful, so great as musicians and as human beings. Particularly, you know, my vocalist, who is presently in Brazil, actually performing with another group. Her name is Kim Nazarian. I always think about recording with vocalists. I mean, vocals is such an important thing for me. It expresses, you know, so many things. The human voice is such a primal, you know, thing. I'm very happy, you know, working with her, and of course we probably will record again. And last year I heard Diane Reeves, and she's great. I would love to do something with her. In terms of other musicians, like a horn player, you know, Michael Brecker is, you know, terrific, you know, the stuff that he does. And this record that is from like 3 or 4 years ago called Two Blocks from the Edge, or something like that. He's got some great stuff. Love to do something with him.
If you had to form a dream band, who would it consist of?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question, Randy. A dream band. I thought about that some time ago. And this last couple of years, and for the Two Worlds project, you know, I really recorded with, you know, a dream band, actually. So if I had to add more musicians to a project like that, or if I had to record with a dream band, so to speak, I would probably, you know, love to do something, like I said, you know, before, you know, Michael Brecker, you know, you know, I would love to do something with, you know, someone like Wayne Shorter. You know, I met John Patitucci not long ago. He would be an incredible thing, you know, to record with him. And there are a few musicians in Brazil that I'd love to do something with. There's a vocalist by the name of Rosa Passos, who I've been listening to the last year or so. Lovely to do something with her as well. And in terms of percussionist, I love to do something with Ciro Batista. You know, been listening to him, especially on the project he did with Herbie Hancock.
Did it take you a long time to record Two Worlds?
Yeah, it did take a while to record Two Worlds. As I think, you know, when you I call the recording studio the Microscope Lab. It's recording studio is very I should say painful process. It's you know, everything comes into light, and you know, whatever you do, you know, it's going to be there forever. So you start to get a little obsessive. I actually, as much as I like to record, I cannot you know, avoid saying, you know, live performances are my favorite thing to do, my favorite, because recordings is a very painstaking, you know, process, and it did take a long time. I you know, the major issue with the recording is to have all the composition all the arrangements ready. You know, when you play live, some things you can get away with a lot of things. However, when you go on record, everything has to be really pretty much set. Then you have to change forms, you have to shorten solos, you have to decide who's soloing. You know, it's more of a mental process. It's not as natural. We try to make it as natural as possible by, you know, recording a lot of things live, by doing a lot of impro, and by the way I work is I let musicians do pretty much what they want with a lot of sections, give them a lot of freedom, and you know what I do is I hire them because I like them, you know, as players and as human beings, and consequently I trust them completely. I trust them with whatever things they have, and I let them do it because usually they come up with great ideas.
Let's talk a little about Miles Davis's influence when it comes to music and the fact that he always surrounded himself with young musicians, and I think that this really benefited him and the music that he produced, because he was always getting fresh ideas. And you know, Art Blakey was the same with his band. I guess that's why they called those two musicians real professors, and they had their own institutions. What are your views on this?
Yes, you bring in a great point, Randy. I'm familiar with Miles Davis' philosophy on that. Yeah, I think it's very important to keep yourself open, you know, to be in contact with musicians who are, you know, maybe from another generation than you are. You know, it can be younger than you, it can be older than you. They definitely contribute, you know, things that you would not come up with. I mean, doing music is a process, a collaborative type of process. It's not, if you're a writer, you write your own book. However, if you're a writer, you also need someone who edits your work or comments on it. So it is also, or can be also, a collaborative project. My father was a painter in Argentina, and he always used to say, I'm pretty much by myself, all the decisions will, you know, fall on me. And I found that really difficult, and I think it's crucial to be involved with other people, stay away from playing always, you know, standards and all things. And even if you play standard, you know, try to play it, you know, your own way, try to find different rhythms, try to find different arrangements, try to change the melodies around, reharm, you know, them and all that.
Did music come naturally to you when you were growing up?
I'm not so sure if it came naturally or not. I recall, you know, going through different stages and working really, really hard at it. Whether it came naturally or not, it's not something I particularly noticed myself. You tend to be influenced by, you know, the places or people that you grew up with, and the places and that you've been, and Buenos Aires in the 60s and 70s, you know, was a heavy cultural, you know, city to grow up. And there was a lot happening. There was a lot of theater, a lot of, the rock and roll movement was starting then. Back then, in fact, it was very high on an Argentinian musician. His name is Luis Alberto Spinetta, and I used to go to his recitals and all that. And I'm sure all that contributed, you know, to my development.
Was there any defining moment in your life where you knew that this is what you wanted to do? You wanted to perform, you wanted to play and sing as well.
Yes, there are. There is a defining moment in my life when I was in high school, and we were all into the Beatles, and I used to get together with my friend in Argentina to, you know, he had a book of the Beatles tunes, and you know, I would bring my bombo leguero, which is the one of the main percussion instruments in Argentina, you play sambas and chacareras with, and he will bring his guitar, and I will just bang into into the bombo. He will just play some guitar. We will sing together, and do some harmonies and stuff like that. I think you know they were such a great writers, and the their concept of melody and you know songwriting and all that was so strong. Even to these days, you know, my daughter, you know, listens to the Beatles and listens to the new stuff, and even admits to myself, she's only, you know, 10 years old, like, you know, wow, daddy, you know, these songs of these guys, you know, the Beatles were, you know, they're so good, you know, she says. So, I mean, that period, I would think that is what made me decide, okay, you know, this is something that I really enjoyed a lot. Also, a trip I made to Brazil, you know, in the late 70s, and I was really blown away, and you know, all this percussion on the street, you know, same thing happened when I went for the first time to Uruguay, which has all this candombe in the streets of Montevideo. So yeah, those can be, you know, the two or three moments in my life.
When you were growing up, what did you listen to?
Strangely enough, I didn't listen to a lot of jazz, actually. I listened to, you know, my father had a great collection, so I listened a little bit of jazz. So I was aware of Oscar Peterson and, you know, and Stan Getz and people like that. But mainly I listened to a lot of Argentinian rock, such as, you know, Luis Alberto Spinetta that I mentioned before. And, you know, Lito Nebbia was another, you know, singer there. And I listened to a lot of folkloric music from there. Down there, Mercedes Sosa, and I still listen to her, and she's terrific. And I didn't listen to a lot of jazz. I actually learned jazz when I came to the United States.
Were your parents musical?
Actually, my mother was. My mother was quite musical. She used to sing in a choir, you know, and she did it for free, and she would go because she was, you know, enjoying doing that. And so sometimes she would take me to rehearsals, and, you know, when I was a little kid, and, you know, I was really enjoying like crazy listening to, you know, what the vocals will do. My father wasn't super musical, but, you know, he always enjoyed jazz. He was a painter. Actually, he was he did quite well in Argentina, and then traveled a little bit, you know, in the U.S. and Europe. And there was a lot of art in the house while I was growing up. Definitely a lot of art. A lot of you know, always actors hanging out, or you know, artists and people like that.
If you were stranded on a desert island, what 10 recordings would you take with you?
Yeah, I would probably take with me a record that Wayne Shorter did. It's called Native Dancer. It features Milton Nascimento. That's a wonderful recording. It's one of the pioneer records in which, you know, Milton is using his voice as an instrument, you know, in something that I've been doing myself since the 80s, and it's a terrific combination. I will probably take Crescent, a John Coltrane record, any of the records that Egberto Gismonti has done. I will take the live in Carnegie Hall, Miles Davis. Wayne Shorter has, you know, many recordings. Probably I will take any of them. Michael Brecker, the record I mentioned earlier on the interview, Two Blocks from the Edge, is an incredible recording. I think that's about it.
What other instruments do you play?
Yes, I play, you know, a lot of hand percussion. Actually, I've been doing a lot of that, using a lot of hand percussion to play as a side musician. Most recently, did a great show at in Boston at the Symphony Hall with the Dizzy Gillespie Alumni All Stars with John Faddis, you know, and I only play percussion, and there I didn't play the drum set. Playing percussion is a great thing. I really enjoy it. You know, you just have to color. You know, the main painting is done, and you just have to color and put a little bit of sparks here and there, and it's just like composing, you know, live. I also play a little bit of piano. I use the piano to compose, and a little bit of guitar too.
What do you feel is your most satisfying recording to date?
Actually, my most recent release, Two Worlds, which was released by Dreambox Media, you know, the label is out of Philly in the U.S., also South and JVC in Japan. It's a record in which, you know, I finally combine a lot of the stuff that I've been writing in the last few years, a big part of the 90s, and also a record where I was able to invite to play a lot of the musicians that I've been working for part of the 90s, and it was an incredible thing because not only they were happy to play with me, but they were also available. As you may well know, musicians are schedule is you know, absurd, you know, to try to get everybody in the same room. It's almost impossible. In fact, you know, this musician from Argentina, I think it was Jorge López Ruiz, he's a bass player from Argentina. You know, he had a great definition of music, and I thought he asked me one time, you know, would you know what the definition of music is? And I started to go blah blah blah, you know, for half an hour, and he interrupted me. He says, no. Music is the art of combining musicians' schedules. And I thought it was, you know, quite right, you know, his definition.
Did you choose the music for Two Worlds?
I actually did not choose all the music myself. I had a pre-production assistant from a trombone player who lives in New York, in Pittsburgh. You know, his name is Jay Ashby. He helped me a lot, you know, to choose the music that we recorded in Two Worlds. He's an experienced trombone player and an arranger. And recently he was touring with Paul Simon. And he's terrific to have in your team, a terrific person to have around, Jay Ashby.
Do you ever find that at some point in a person's life, they tend to lose that feeling of what it means to be a child and everything that goes with it? I'm more focused on the creativity aspect and the sense of discovery.
Yes, funny that you mentioned that. I actually recently saw a program, it probably was a repeat program. I don't know if you ever watch, and there's a station, a cable TV station called Bravo in the U.S. An interviewer at the Actor Studio in New York, and he was interviewing actor Alan Alda, and one of the big piece of advice he had for his fellows actors and students and all that was, you know, try to always stay a child, you know, don't ever grow up, don't ever lose that, and I couldn't agree with that more. Staying a child not only allows you to be more free, but allows you to be more open to not to have any preconcepts about anything. I watch the children that surround me in my life these days, and I try to be with them as much as possible. It's just, no one else gives you that perspective, and no one else puts you in your center.
One thing I've always tried to do in my life is to always keep a sense of fluidity and flexibility in my thinking, so that when I conceptualize an idea, I'm not working in a rigid framework. And I was just curious to see what your what your comments are on this.
It's true. I think it's good to have an idea to you know, to kind of have a foundation for what you're trying to do. In the, you know, the creative process is you know, it's always a work in progress, so to speak. But you do have to have some concept down, and then you have to kind of keep it you know, light, in a sense that you have to sort of take that concept and be able to change it around into what is A in your tune could easily become B, or could be, or could not be there anymore, you know, when you are ready to bring the tune to the rehearsal. It's kind of hard to establish a rule about that, however, because sometimes, you know, you don't have any concept or you don't have any idea, and then by improvising you come up with a, you know, firm concept. So it's sort of a two-way street.
Do you prefer performing or composing?
I think I prefer performing. Writing is vital for me, but performing is such a primal thing. I mean, in the I really take a lot of pleasure from how musicians and the audience react to whatever you're doing. It's something that I will miss. You know, sometimes I wonder, and I say to myself, well, why don't I just do some writing for a while and don't perform? I don't know. I think performing is a very difficult thing, because sometimes you have to be traveling or carrying your equipment, or you know, being, you know, getting home late and things like that, or being, you know, out of town. Even sometimes, you know, you may be in another continent or whatever, and it's not easy. But it's just the pleasure of being in a collaborative aspect is what I'm indicating.
Do ideas come to you quickly when you're composing?
Yeah, how did you guess, Randy? That's a very good question. It does take a long time. It does take a long time, especially if you're selective and, you know, you want to come up with something good. Actually, I used to study, up until recently, I was taking lessons with a great professor. His name is Charlie Banakos. He actually said, in order to have great ideas, you have to work at it, you know, almost every day. Now, it's hard to find time to do that every day, but if you don't, then it takes you longer to come up with good ideas. There's no question about that. And composition is a very, very lengthy process. It's not something that can just happen, you know, by itself. You need to sort of, first of all, work at it every day. And even if you do, it doesn't mean that you're going to come up with a good material. But, you know, you need to be in touch with, you know, you need to, like we say in the biz, you know, sharp your tools, you know, every day.
There are some performers who prefer playing in a trio setting, and others prefer an orchestral setting, and others a small group setting. Do you have any preference?
It depends the period of my life. You know, lately I've been playing a lot on a trio situation. Sometimes, you know, with either my group or as a sideman, I get jobs as a trio, me playing drums, and then acoustic bass or electric bass and piano, and I've been enjoying that more than I thought I was going to enjoy it. And the reason being is because there's a lot of room to do different things. When you have a bigger group, you know, there's less room, and you have to be, you have to save a lot. You know, you have to be really stingy with what you play, otherwise you get in the way of people. But this last period, I would think that I'm enjoying a lot playing in a smaller ensemble, either a trio or at the most a quartet. And strangely enough, I was playing with a percussionist a lot, you know, up until a year ago, a year and a half. This year I've been enjoying a lot not to play with the percussionist. There's new things I'm discovering because of it.
Do you enjoy touring outside of North America?
Yes, I do. I definitely think that this kind of music, Brazilian, Argentine jazz, or Latin jazz, or Afro-Cuban jazz, is very much liked in places like Europe and Japan. When I went to Japan, I noticed that people were incredibly receptive and incredibly respectful. Of course, playing in the U.S. is great. I enjoy very much doing that, except that, since there's an abundance of musicians here, there's a lot of the main groups are based in the U.S., primarily in New York or places like Boston or Los Angeles. Or Chicago, of course, people are less receptive to it and perhaps less appreciative. But I can't, define this in general terms. Recently, I played in New Hampshire in a small restaurant, and you couldn't hear a fly, in the room. People were totally silent, listening to every single note. So it depends where you go.
Many musicians have commented on the level of respect shown to them when they're traveling to Europe or even Japan.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I agree with these musicians who have, said that. I experienced that myself. Is first of all, places like France or Spain, Italy, their jazz festivals are, so incredible. There are like hundreds of festivals. The cultural life, in Europe and is so much alive. I mean, there's so much, hunger for it. I mean, Buenos Aires, where I come from in Argentina, is also an incredible receptive city. So is Rio de Janeiro as well. I think that people in Europe, in European cities in Latin America, are incredibly torn to the arts in general. Not only music, but theater, children theater, mime. I can never forget when I saw for the first time this group who is based in, I think, in Switzerland, called Mumenschanz. And I saw them in Argentina, and you couldn't find a ticket. I mean, it was a whole week. It was completely sold out, for weeks in advance. I mean, it's really incredible.
Your version of Fragile is so beautiful. Now, what is it about Sting's music that is so appealing to many musicians?
Thanks very much, Randy. I like the way we did it too, and I'm not so sure what is it that that appeals to musicians, to this artist, Sting. I think he has a clear a sense of different styles of music. He's also an incredible vocalist. My personal reason for choosing that tune, Fragile, is also because this tune has become like a world anthem for peace. This tune was sung for by many different artists. Among them, Mercedes Sosa from Argentina has sung the song. And Sting used that song in Argentina when he went there and sang it on the stage and called, the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, the famous group who has done so much for all the atrocities that happened in the late 70s and early 80s in Argentina, the Dirty War and all that stuff. Sting is also, of course, an incredible writer, and has brought jazz to his music in a very refined way.
One of my favorite trumpet players is Claudio Roditi.
Yeah, I agree with you. Claudio is a great asset to have around. I met Claudio actually in Canada when I went to play at the Montreal Jazz Festival. We were hanging out in the hotel. He was incredibly friendly, and he was staying in the same hotel I was staying. And he said, yeah, call me sometime. We definitely should do something. And it wasn't until 1991 that we finally were able to invite him to a show in Boston, where I live, in one of the big clubs in this area. Actually, it's in Cambridge, called the Regatta Bar. He's been more than a person that I just hired to play. He's been a mentor in many ways.
If I were to feature a selection from Two Worlds, what would you like to hear?
I'd like you to play, Randy. How about Partido Final? That's a tune that uses a rhythm that I enjoy playing myself so much. It's called Partido Alto, rhythm from Brazil. And I love the development of the melody of that tune. In Partido Final, it means the final game. I'm thinking about, the soccer or the World Cup, the very last game of the whole sort of tournament, and when everybody's really, really tired, but it's excitement, and that's the whole thing. And that's why it starts in the A section, with a very laid-back melody, where I specifically asked the singer to sing as she's, kind of tired and all that. But then it picks up, towards the middle, in which, the team has got to really kick, to make it to the final. So it's Partido Final, which is the final game, and it uses the Partido Alto rhythm, which, in other words, is a play on words.
Okay, I'm going to give you some names that I'd like you to just discuss the first thing that comes to mind. So let's get started. How about Duke Ellington?
Dark. That's what comes to mind. But also deep. Brilliant.
And what about the great arranger Gil Evans?
Ethereal. Air. Garden. Green. Light.
And I'm sure this next one is someone that's dear to you, someone who's close to you musically, the great Paquito de Rivera.
Fun, funny, generous, a pioneer.
And of course, we can't forget Mr. Herb Pomeroy.
He was actually one of my mentors when I was in school, so I cannot think highly enough of Herb. Mentor, brilliant arranger, brilliant faculty and teacher, and an incredible trumpet player as well.
One thing I've noticed in recent years is the sorry state of popular music, and I just wanted to know what your opinion was with the current situation.
I couldn't agree with you more. This generation has come up with some music that is, to put it mildly, really sad. There is a constant repetition, and even children that I know tell me, and that I come in contact with when I teach and stuff like that, how great the tunes of some of the old rock and roll groups were. And then you wonder, why is it that the Rolling Stones, you know, are still around and touring and all that? You know, is and I, and the answer is, you know, they have great tunes. I mean, the music that was done, you know, a few years ago is, you know, it's just timeless music. And the last groups that we have around is really, really, you know, difficult. It makes me, you know, sad. It's also the political and social message of some of these groups or some of these singers, and I don't want to mention names whatsoever. It's also non-existent, which is really something, you know, I would say dangerous.
What was the most important thing that you learned when you were studying at Berkeley in Boston?
I can't single out as to one important thing. The most important thing, I guess, that I learned at Berkeley is how to get along with people from such a different backgrounds and such a different places, you know, from the world. When I came to Argentina, I hadn't, you know, traveled that much, and I thought I was going to only meet, you know, North Americans, and I didn't. I met people from all over the world, from Brazil, from Russia, from France, from Chile, from Argentina, from Romania, from China. That was a mind-blowing experience.
You spent some time at the Conservatory of Music in Argentina. What was that like?
Yes, I did spend some time at the conservatory in Buenos Aires. The conservatory back then was kind of difficult to be there, mainly because of the situation in the country. It was still under military dictatorship in the late 70s and early 80s. I remembering as if it was yesterday, one time showing up at the conservatory in sandals, and you know, the assistant to the director of the conservatory stopped me and scolded me and told me, you know, you can't wear sandals when you come to the conservatory. You can't wear your hair long. It was very, very difficult to be there studying music, which it should be, you know, studied in an environment where freedom is the primary thing, because in order to do music, you have to feel that you have room to do it. So I knew I had to do it because I needed to have some background and come to the United States with something, but it was just not easy at all.
Do you remember the first concert that you ever attended?
That was in Buenos Aires. It was a while ago. I don't want to tell you when, so then you'll guess my age. So I'm not gonna tell you what year was that. But it was in a teatro called Teatro El Nacional. It was a competition. You know, a bunch of rock bands were there. It was quite something. It was really great.
I know this could be a tough question, but I was just wondering, what was the best concert that you've ever seen?
The best concert is hard to answer that question. I've seen so many great, amazing things. I could think of Astor Piazzolla playing at the auditorium in Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. He had a cello player with him that day. Bragato is his last name. He also had a composer and piano player, Gerardo Gandini. I remember a lot of well-known musicians were in the audience, Gary Barton and people like that when I looked. That was truly something. I think I was in tears, you know, for most of the concert. That was really remarkable.
Do you spend a lot of time practicing?
I do and I don't. Depends the period of my life. This last year I've been doing a lot of shedding in my studio, which is in the South End. It's an area of Boston, very nice, where I actually teach and have, you know, see students there. I am developing new techniques, new things, especially to warm up, something that I didn't do in the past. And I develop with the help of a wonderful teacher. His name is Gary Chafee. He's a terrific educator and a terrific player too. He's been showing me some stuff to relax and to go over, you know, sort of a routine before you actually either play live or start to practice, and it's a series of exercises that are great to develop your wrist motion and your fingers as well.
If you'd never pursued a career in jazz, what could you see yourself doing instead?
I'm not so sure for what I would have done if I didn't do what I'm doing these days. But it comes to mind, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the show Seinfeld, you know, that we have in the U.S. But you know, I love when the character played by Jason Alexander George, when he's asked what does he do, he always answers, you know, I'm an architect. So I guess if I didn't do music, I would be an architect.
Do you do a lot of teaching, Guillermo?
Been teaching for a few years or so. Recently, I was teaching at a conservatory here in Boston called the New England Conservatory. I do teach, you know, out of my studio, and I teach drums. And no, I do not do many clinics at all. I've done a few in the past. No, recently I haven't. It's something that I just, you know, didn't come across, you know, so I haven't done it, you know, for a while.
So what's left for you to do in terms of music?
Yes, of course, there's many, many things I would love to do musically. You know, primarily I've been thinking a lot about strings lately for some reason. I think, you know, I love to do stuff, you know, with either some cello. You know, I listen to a Caetano Veloso recording in which, you know, Jack Morellenbaum is playing cello, and also he's playing with in a live record with Sting. And somehow, I mean, he's such a great arranger and performer. And somehow I thought about a lot about cello and you know, violin and viola and stuff like that. That's something I would like to explore farther.
What projects are in the works for 2003?
I actually been talking to the promoter of a management company in the Massachusetts area. It's called Water Music. I'm thinking about doing a concert in the fall. It's going to be a big concert, you know, at the main club in this area. It's called the Regatta Bar in Cambridge. Primarily, we talked about, you know, the day before Thanksgiving here in the U.S. is a day that we've done many times, and it works out nicely for us. A lot of people are in town, contrary to what people think. So November 26th of 2003, I'm preparing a new concert. I think this time, instead of having a trumpet player come and play with us from New York, I'm going to have a trombone player, and it's probably going to be Jay Ashby coming to play with us. So I'm very excited about that, you know, and just thinking about doing some arrangements for trombone, and he also plays percussion. He's a great percussionist, actually. Then after that, I probably gonna start to write some new material if I have the time for that.
Where do you see the role of the musician in society? You know, back in 1978, Stanley Clarke was quoted in Downbeat magazine as saying that, you know, musicians should be placed at the top of the hierarchy and not so much politicians. And I was just wondering what your views are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I do have a couple of comments about that. And as artist, you know, any kind of artist in society, I call, you know, an English artist only refers to painters many times, but any kind of artists, actors. I work a lot, you know, with actors in the past. I worked at an institution in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called the American Repertory Theater, in theater or writing or film or music or any of the areas of art. I think they're vital for anybody, and even people who are not even aware of it. I'll bet they do something artistic or have some connection with the arts, even if they don't know it. I always think about, you know, a carpenter is an artist, a great carpenter, you know, he or she, they have to figure out how to come up with a, you know, a great piece of furniture or a great set of shelves or whatever. So yes, I will also mention artists, you know, in that order, the way, you know, you've mentioned it.
I'm curious, tell us about your first live gig as a professional.
Yes, I do. It was I was very young. It was in a beautiful theater in Buenos Aires that we actually, my friends and I rented, you know, because that was the only way of getting a gig, you know, and trusted that a bunch of our friends will come, you know, to see us. And we were in high school. Yes, I'm remembering before I went into stage, I was basically, to put it mildly, I was shitting on my pants. It was very, very scary. I continued to be scared, you know, for many years after that, until I, you know, I performed for many years. So for all of you who want to perform, you know, you ought to know that it gets better. But it never really completely, that scary, exciting dash, you know, not being totally yourself thing goes away. You always worry about your next thing. You're always thinking about it. It may go away once you're on the stage, but it's always there.
Guillermo, what music are you listening to these days?
I've been listening to a lot of jazz, like the bebop, you know, era of jazz. You may think that's strange, you know, for a Latino musician, but that's where I am at these days. I'm you know, studying and listening, you know, to a lot of, you know, Elvin and Coltrane and Miles and from the 60s and stuff that I just never had the time to really listen in a deep way, and now I feel the need for it.
Are there any funny musical stories that you'd like to share with us today?
Yes, I have many of those. I mean, musicians, I always feel the musicians should be comedians. Most of them are, anyway, and they're, you know, some of them are hysterical. Actually, let me tell you about something that didn't happen to me, but it happened to my piano player. His name is Elio Alves, A-L-V-E-S. He was touring with Gatto Barbieri, you know, a famous worldwide, you know, saxophone player. For some reason, you know, Gatto, you know, has a hard time remembering musicians, even though this percussionist who has been playing with him for 20 years, he couldn't remember his name, you know, and he was playing with him for 20 years. So one time in Blue Note, Elio was there, and he's ready to introduce this guy, and his name was actually Guilherme Franco, same name than me, but he's from Brazil. And he introduced him, and you know, took like a 10-minute introduction. The guy was like, you know, almost uncomfortable. Okay, this excellent percussionist playing with me, you know, and he's like, you know, in addition to that, his English is pretty broken English, and some of the times he was talking in Spanish too, and to an audience, to an American audience at the Blue Note in New York City. Finally, after 10 minutes introduction, he says, "And on percussion, Plinio." So, like, in 10 minutes introduction, you know, and then he screws up, you know, his name. So I thought that was hysterical.
How has the internet affected your life?
It has affected it, but I'm not so sure exactly in what way. It's one thing is great, obviously, that you know, musicians like myself, jazz musicians who were able to were I'm I should say weren't able to reach a lot of people. Now they're able to because of the internet. Not only that, you could do a lot of the preparation for concerts through email these days, which it really saves time and money, especially long distance. If you're trying to set up a concert in whatever, North Carolina, you can just do email, and it's much cheaper that way and much more effective. The difficult thing for me is to keep up with all the technology and all that. It's very time consuming, and I, you know, don't have very much time, and I don't want to invest any time. I want to use it, you know, to write music. The very little time I have, you know, that I want to dedicate to my family and friends, and write music. So that's a difficult part of it. But there's no question that there's many positive aspects to it, and I enjoyed some of them quite a bit. You know, be able to transfer, you know, music over the internet, be able to transfer images, you know, a press kit, a photo, you know, and things like that. It's really terrific.